the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to.
Do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Hey, thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Today we're going to take a break from Washington politics and intrigue, talk about nature, and talk about declining pollinator species. If you heard the bee sound effect at the very beginning of the podcast intro, you know that I care about bees and identify with them. We'll get an update on their recovering populations toward the end of this interview. We're going to talk with Victoria Wojcik, who is the research director at Pollinator Partners, about the latest decline in a pollinating species, this time the beautiful monarch butterfly. On the West Coast Flyway, there's been a 90% decline in their population, and we don't know why. I'm grateful to the people who pollinate the Peter B. Collins podcast. And I'm referring to those of you who subscribe, like my friend Susan Gavet, Jens Nielsen, Chris Welsh, and Gene Kenny. They're monthly subscribers, and I would like you to join them. Just go to peterbcollins.com, and under my mugshot, it says, Sign Up Now. You'll get a choice of $5, $10, $20 a month for our monthly subscription. You can cancel that anytime. Or the best deal is our $50 annual subscription. And if you're a new annual subscriber in the continental U.S., you get bonus gifts, including a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans supplied by Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. And we've got the new rock CD with great political themes by John Dist called Red Flag. I'll send you one of each if you sign up as a new annual subscriber. Hey, and the other way you can support us, whether you're a subscriber or not, is to accept our offer for a free 30-day trial at audible.com. And if you sign up for that, Audible will give you your first audiobook download absolutely free. And they won't charge you if you cancel before 30 days. Either way, audible.com will pay $15 to yours truly for each trial membership that we get credit for. Follow the links from the banner ad at peterbcollins.com. For the third year in a row, the monarch butterfly population is declining. What's nature telling us?
Nature's weak, telling you something's wrong. It's nature's weak, telling you in a song.
Here at the Peter B. Collins Show, we are partial to pollination. We use an animated bee as a graphic logo to represent our podcast. I need some help to understand the decline in critical pollinating populations of species, and it is rather sharp, as we'll see here in our discussion with Victoria Wojcik. She has a doctorate in the, biology. She's from, the degree is from the University of Berkeley, and she is the research director at the Pollinator Partnership based here in San Francisco. Vicki Wojcik, welcome to our program.
Happy to be here.
And sorry to fumble around about your degree. Tell us exactly what you studied.
specifically environmental science policy and management out at Berkeley, but I focused on pollinators finding habitat in human-dominated landscapes.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And give us a quick the elevator pitch on the Pollinator Partnership. Who are you? What's your focus? And who funds you?
Perfect. Well, Pollinator Partnership, we're a 501c3 nonprofit, and our focus is on the pollinators, the birds, bees, bats, butterflies, all those critters that bring us the food we eat, support the ecosystems we enjoy, and basically maintain life as we know it. Our scope is continental, so we're really looking at pollinators in Canada, the United States, and Mexico, because pollinators don't see the political boundaries that we draw.
Yeah.
They follow habitats and live in ecosystems, and that's what we protect.
Mm-hmm. And give us just a little sketch of your own travels in pursuit of the science. Have you visited, for example, the areas in Mexico where the monarchs have regularly spawned? I don't know what spawned. I don't know what they
They're
do.
They're overwintering grounds. So
they hang out there,
yeah. I haven't personally been that lucky to go down quite that far, but I have made it to the Pacific Flyway Wintering Grounds in Pacific Grove.
Mm-hmm.
So I have seen them, and they're beautiful and wonderful, and it's something I recommend everyone do to understand just how great the journey of this tiny insect is.
Yeah. And I have spent time in the Monterey area, and Pacific Grove is adjacent to Monterey along the California coast. And the monarchs are just amazing. and the colors and the, you know, when they are congregating there, it's just such an impressive sight. And it really feeds the word awesome, which is often abused.
I definitely agree with that. It's quite a phenomenon.
Now, let's focus a little bit on the monarch butterflies because, as I mentioned, there has been a measurable sharp decline over the past 3 years. And tell us about the population and its migration patterns and how we've been able to discern that there has been a significant decline over the past 3 years.
Certainly. So monarch butterflies, they really capture the imagination. They're pretty, they're colorful, and scientists have been studying them for a long time, too, trying to figure out where all these butterflies are going to and coming from. And there's a pretty good network of monarch watchers out there, a great organization that we work with that's out of the University of Kansas, Lawrence. Monarch Watch, headed by Chip Taylor, is involved in a monarch tagging program. So monarchs can be tagged. If you catch one, the monarch then flies where it's going to fly, and other people that are out there conscious that there's these tagged monarchs out there keep an eye out. And when they see a monarch, they check to see if it has a tag. And so there's this huge continental-scale data collection network out there, and that's been in place for over a decade. So we really do have good ideas about how many monarchs are moving, when they first move, where they're going through.
Now, how do these little winged creatures fly so far? Because their migration occurs over hundreds, if not thousands, of miles.
So the actual odometer reading on that one would be 3,000 miles that they travel annually.
Wow.
In their migration. It's a little bit, it's still very, very impressive because of their size, but it's a little bit of a misnomer in the sense that a single butterfly makes that journey. It's actually the entire population, which is what makes their migration so much more fascinating, how they know where to go and when to go.
Mm-hmm.
So within the northern and southern movements of monarch migrations, there are multiple generations. So a monarch might be born in Texas, but that monarch itself, on its northern journey through the northern United States into southern Canada, will never make it to southern Canada. But its granddaughter will.
So it's a relay, a generational relay race.
It is, absolutely.
And what is the, you know, general lifespan of an individual monarch butterfly?
They live for a couple months, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They're not particularly long-lived, with the exception of the populations that overwinter in southern California, southern Florida, and northern Mexico. They go into sort of a hibernation state, for lack of better words, and they can hang out for multiple months, and then they mate, fly a little bit north, lay an egg, and then their life is over, and
mm-hmm.
the next life starts.
Wow. And give us a quick sketch of what ecosystems support the butterflies. What is their source of food and nutrition?
Well, sure. And so this is the thing that's really fascinating about monarchs. Pretty much all ecosystems throughout North America, because of the diversity of habitats you see across the continent, all of those ecosystems have something in them that can support a monarch. For the caterpillar, so the infantile stage of this particular species, mm-hmm. it's milkweed. Lots of different species of milkweed plants. But for the adult monarchs, it's nectar that also comes from a variety of plant species, and I'd be at a loss to name them all off, but mm-hmm. something that my organization has produced, Pollinator Partnership, or a series of planting guides that tell you what you should think of planting or preserving in your particular geographic region, that will help the monarchs.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So the New York Times published a story on January 29th, and they cite studies and just observations conducted in the Sierra Madre in Mexico, which is a zone where, you know, historically, the migration has reached, I guess, its southern terminus. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, one of three potential southern resting spots, and it's the largest. So the monarch migration across the North American continent actually has three dominant flyways, almost like bird migratory flyways. There's an Atlantic flyway that really does hug the coast of Atlantic Canada down through the United States. Mm-hmm. And those monarchs can overwinter in spots in Florida, and then they sometimes can also join the central flyway, which goes just over the Mississippi almost, the way a lot of migratory birds go. And that larger flyway's overwintering ground is in northern Mexico. Mm-hmm. And then there's a third flyway, it's the Pacific flyway, and these are butterflies that go as far north as southern British Columbia and then come down through the Cascades, and they overwinter in Pacific Grove.
Okay. And I'm trying to think of the mechanics of this migration. Do they hitch rides with birds?
No, it's all self-powered. So this is where they have to make sure that they're getting enough food and putting on enough fat. And I know that's a funny concept when you think about an insect getting fat. But it's the job of that monarch caterpillar to eat, get as fat as it can, metamorphosize into an adult, and then fly as far as it can. And it takes a lot of energy from food sources. So this is where the problem has occurred in monarch numbers declining. The habitat where they find food is fragmented, lost, or deteriorated, and they're struggling to be able to fuel their flight and make it to where they need to be.
And Vicki, do they fly over open water? I mean, you talked about that central migration along the Mississippi, and there's a big Gulf of Mexico between New Orleans.
They tend to stay landlocked. Butterflies, like most terrestrial insects, aren't the best swimmers.
Yeah.
So water is not their friend. I mean, they certainly need water in their diet, but mm-hmm. they tend to lap up water from the very, very edges of stream beds or little puddles. Otherwise, they wouldn't make it. So you won't see these flying over the Gulf.
Now, the statistics are a little stunning here. According to the New York Times, the population has shrunk to about 35 million. This, again, looking at the area in Mexico. And they make their estimates based on the amount of forest that is inhabited by these overwintering monarchs. And they say that in the past, for example, in 1996, they occupied about 45 acres of forest. And in the observations just a month ago, it was under 2 acres. So that is an incredible sharp decline, and that assumes that the distribution of monarchs per acre is about the same as it was in 96, which may or may not be the case.
Well, you know, and you're right, and so the decline you're speaking of is close to 90% that has been seen in this particular year. The Pacific migration that I mentioned, that one has suffered huge declines for the past few years. That wasn't a surprise to scientists to find out that the numbers weren't that great. But this sharp decline in the core Central and Atlantic migration flyways really is troubling, and it's a sign that not enough monarchs are making it down to their southern range because they can't make it down. They can't fly from one habitat site to another with the energy they have because the patches of habitats are getting too far apart.
Now, are we sure that they, you know, haven't created new condos for monarchs somewhere along the way, and they're just stopping short of what used to be their destination?
Well, we can't be 100% sure that they haven't found another spot to nest, to reside for the cooler months. But with the Monarch Watch team that's out there waiting for monarchs every year to pass through their locations, we've seen the numbers declining even in the further north parts of the migration. So closer to the start of the southern migration, the numbers were low and fewer were getting there. So we had reports from, you know, states like Pennsylvania and Virginia, not a lot of monarchs. Georgia, not a lot of monarchs. You know, further north, not a lot of monarchs. A great colleague of mine that works up in Canada, who's from Prince Edward Island, she was down at Point Pelee National Park, which is Canada's southernmost national park, and they have a big monarch watching day. And they saw only one, when in years they see thousands, hundreds of thousands. So there is trouble along the migration route. They're not there, period. They're not just switching routes.
And do we have theories? I open with that great song by Spirit. It's nature's way of telling us there's something wrong. What is wrong, Vicki?
Well, together, all the research, because there's a lot of research out there. Again, people love monarchs. They're very pretty, they're captivating, their biology is fascinating, and there's a lot of people out there looking and studying them. It really is habitat loss. Different factors are driving habitat loss in different regions. So, for example, in California and throughout the West, there have been so many successive drought years. The one we're coming up to this year, well, that's a extra special drought, I suppose, but even in the past few years, the drought has been so strong that the biomass of milkweed, the physical number of milkweed plants and how big they are, how hardy they are, has been diminished. So those monarch butterflies have less food.
Mm-hmm.
In the central flyway, it's a little bit more complicated. So way back when agriculture was practiced the way it was practiced way back when, you had a lot of weediness in the landscape. And by weediness, I don't mean necessarily weeds that you'd want to get rid of, but things that aren't what the farmer planted, growing in a ditch, growing at the side of the road. And those actually were the milkweeds and the native plant nectar plants that the monarchs would feed off of. But a lot of land has transformed from standard corn varieties to a lot of herbicide-resistant corn varieties and soy varieties. So now when pesticide treatments and herbicide treatments occur in this landscape, they can be used more indiscriminately. And these weeds in the corners that were feeding the wildlife throughout the Midwest really were knocked out. So now there's no accidental food in this landscape for the monarchs. So there's nothing for them to eat there.
And is there any substitute? As you're talking about weed, I'm thinking of the biggest cash crop in California and the product that is now legal in Washington State.
Well, unfortunately, for the monarch caterpillar, there is no substitute for milkweed. Milkweed is a general name that refers to a variety of different species of milkweeds, but it's a special type of plant that has a toxin in it that the caterpillars are immune to. They eat this, and it's what gives them their chemical defenses against predators. So monarch caterpillars need milkweeds. You can't convince them to eat any other plant out there.
All right. And is the widespread use of pesticides a major suspect in the decline of the monarch migration?
It is, in the sense that pesticide is a term used broadly like an umbrella, and a weed would definitely be a pest. So it would be herbicide use that's the dominant culprit in the monarch migration. So to be clear, it is not a situation where monarchs themselves are encountering insecticides
mm-hmm.
and being harmed. Their food supply is being decimated by herbicides in that category of pesticides.
Now, let me ask you about one thing, and I think it's pretty clear. I don't have much of a science background here, Vicki. But I recently saw a fascinating report on public television about the sharp decline in the starfish population along the entire Pacific coastline of North America. And I was fascinated by it. I thought the report examined many potential causes. And, of course, warming of the oceans is a likely contributor in the case of the starfish decline. But one thing that they didn't even raise as a possibility is the radiation from the meltdown of the Fukushima nuclear reactor plants. And I'm just curious if that's something that is on your radar as some sort of a contributor to the monarch decline, or do you believe that it is, you know, closely related to the decline in milkweed habitat?
Well, I certainly would think it's more in habitat. I actually hadn't even made that connection or thought in that direction much. But the earlier part of your comment there on climate change activities and, as being one potential factor with the starfish, climate change also can severely impact plants and pollinators. And here's why. Plants tend to respond by blooming or creating fruit and growing in response to sunlight patterns, which actually aren't changing very much. The day lengths change as we circle the sun, but human factors aren't impacting how long the day is. Whereas insects, they develop based on temperature. They need certain temperatures at certain times of the year, and then their bodies know that it's time to hatch out of your chrysalis and go on being a butterfly, for example. With climate change patterns, what's happening is with warming areas and some cooling areas, you have a dissociation with a process that used to happen at the exact same time, the hatching of a pollinator and the blooming of a flower. Now we're occurring at different time periods because day lengths stay the same, but temperatures change. And that's problematic, very much so, for these species, because they can either arrive too early and there's no food, or arrive late and the food's all gone.
And Vicki, the New York Times report indicates that last year there was an unusual cold snap in Texas that delayed the monarch's northward migration, and that threw off their reproductive cycles, it appears.
Absolutely. You know, they are a fine-tuned machine, this mass of millions of butterflies that are moving across the continent. They've been doing it for longer than we've been on this Earth, and they really have it down to, you know, an exact science, so to speak, from their perspective. And if there are bumps around the road, they can handle some of it.
Mm-hmm.
They can, you know, maybe go a little further until the next patch of food. But if they really are held back by a few weeks because of weather, winds, temperature, everything, they could miss their food absolutely, and then there's nowhere for them to go.
And I'm not connecting this directly to the monarchs. It's just a personal anecdote. I believe it was the summer of 2011. I went camping with some friends up near Lake Tahoe, and this was on the California side of the summit. And there had been a very long winter, and the final snowmelt didn't occur until the 4th of July. And so I was there in the first week of August, and the black flies that are typically a nuisance in June were in great population, or at least they were apparent because we were using a lot of bug juice and smacking them a lot, and so that was just one of those indicators about how the seasonal clock can get off kilter, and the plants and insect populations will inevitably follow it.
You're absolutely correct, and that's something I hope that is a learning point, take-home message from our conversation here, that it's a very complicated system and there's lots of variables, but seasonal climatic patterns are huge in this particular issue and for a lot of pollinator issues.
So I want to get an update on the decline in the bee population. Is there anything else that I haven't asked you about that you'd like to add about the situation confronting the monarch population?
Well, I would just say from my perspective and the work that my organization does, we try to reach out and show anyone how they can help protect and promote pollinator species. And planting habitat or helping restore these losses and gaps in habitat for monarchs is key. So I would encourage everyone to plant their locally appropriate milkweed and nectar plants for monarch butterflies throughout their landscapes. And if they do visit our website, pollinator.org, we have a zip code coded location system where you can put in your zip code and it tells you what to plant right away. So we've streamlined that for you.
So I'm looking at the website, and it's under the tab marked Planting Guides?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I'm reading it now, Free Pollinator-Friendly Planting Guides. And so you enter your zip code, and then you come back with species that you believe will grow easily on a local basis?
Yeah, we've put a lot of work into this. They're all native species. They're locally appropriate. And if you're using our web-based app version of this planting guide,
uh-huh.
You can also sort the species based on your particular conditions. If you have a lot of sun, not too much. If your soil is wet or dry. So you can narrow it down to even which pollinator you'd like to attract. And there's a butterfly icon if that's what you'd prefer. So if you want to help out monarchs, give that one a try.
Oh, that's cool. And do you have any recommendations? I share my property with a herd of deer. Is there anything, I know that there's no such thing as a deer-proof plant, but some are aromatic and the deer don't care for them.
At that point, I have to giggle a little and say, usually pollinator plants are also tasty for deer plants, so.
Well, I see lavender, though, on your long list here.
Yeah, lavender is much more of a bee plant in that case, so you could definitely plant a row of lavender,
mm-hmm.
keep the deer away, and then put your tastier, more delicate butterfly plants on the other side and hope they don't get to it.
Okay, that's a great strategy. So, Vicki, take a moment here to update us on the bee population, because honeybees have taken a sharp hit. It's been, what, 5 or 6 years now since we noted the decline in their numbers?
In colony collapse disorder, yes. So
mm-hmm.
in terms of what's been going on with bee health in the last 5 to 6 years, colony collapse disorder was a phenomenon that was documented in 2006, 2007. Very narrow and specific set of symptoms where you had a hive that had plenty of brood, which are the developing bees, plenty of honey stored. A queen may or may not have been present, but none of the workers were present. So essentially empty hives, ready to go, full of food, no bees. That particular set of circumstances hasn't resurfaced as a large-scale phenomenon since about 2007. That doesn't mean that was problem solved, everything's okay now. What's been particularly bad this year are numbers of winter deaths or overwintering deaths seen in bees, which have always hovered around the teens. So, for example, 10%, 11%. This past year, they were closer to 30%, which is a huge increase.
Mm-hmm.
So beekeepers are struggling with bee colonies that are not making it through the winter.
And the overall pollinating bee population, has it recovered from its low point, 5, 6 years ago?
It's bounced back enough, and I have to definitely commend the beekeepers for this. Even during the hardest hit period when colony collapse disorder was affecting 50% or more of some beekeepers' hives, they managed to manage the rest of their hives to make up the difference. So they really took on the burden of overcoming what could have been a huge problem for all of us by splitting their hives, feeding them extra to make sure that they build up strength, the ones that remained, and going forward from there. So the beekeepers have managed, against all odds, to keep pollination numbers where they need to be. But how sustainable that is for them economically and, emotionally, personally, no one wants to see their bees die and have to keep working to keep them alive. That's another story, and that's something that definitely needs a lot of outreach and support
mm-hmm.
in the beekeeping community.
And Vicki, have we had time for some forensic studies here, and are there any strong theories about the cause of the bee colony collapse?
There's still a lot of work out there, a lot of competing ideas, because not every hive that showed the symptoms of colony collapse disorder showed the exact same set of symptoms, all of them off of a checklist, and not every hive had the same forensic analysis when everything came back, but what was a pretty consistent factor was all of the hives were infected by the varroa mite, which is a persistent parasite on bees. And bee researchers definitely agree that dealing with the challenges of varroa mite and the stress that it puts on a colony are paramount, because the mite infects colonies, weakens colonies. It's pervasive, so it's really hard to actually have a colony that's free of varroa. With that as a constant pressure, the bees are just that much more susceptible to everything, not just an incredible die-off that occurred with colony collapse disorder, but they're more susceptible to a standard disease that wouldn't have harmed them if they didn't have a parasite.
Mm-hmm. And did I get that right? It's the varroa mite? Like
varroa mite.
Spell that, please.
V-A-R-R-O-A.
Okay, varroa mite.
It sounds very ferocious.
Well, I just thought maybe there's some connection to Vegemite from varroa mite. But
No, not quite. But definitely, it's an external parasite that sucks the body juices out of poor little bees and just makes them not as healthy as they could be. So it would be the equivalent to a human being having a very heavy parasitic infection from an external parasite. Thank goodness we don't have external parasites these days.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the food you eat, you're sharing it with someone else, and you can never get up to tip-top shape. You can't perform.
Yeah. Very interesting. And Vicki, are there any other pollinator species that are at serious risk right now?
Well, there actually are quite a few. There are so many different diverse types of pollinator species that as much as scientists try to find out everything about them, there's definitely still unknowns. But there are quite a few that we know are suffering declines. For example, there are four bumblebee species.
Mm-hmm.
That are listed as threatened, rare, and endangered. One of them, throughout North America, one of them, the rusty patch bumblebee, is considered to be extinct in Canada, and it has very small pocketed populations in the northern part of the United States. That was once its contiguous range between southern Canada and northern United States.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a huge issue there. There's a group of bees, so not a single species, but a group of bees called the yellow-faced bees, and wouldn't you know it, they have a yellow face.
Yeah.
They're very, very unique species, and there's a population that's endemic to Hawaii, so it's Hawaii's only group of native bees. That's a endangered and threatened group there because of habitat loss.
Mm-hmm.
And to move on to an animal pollinator, that's closer to us, like a mammal, the lesser long-nosed bat, which lives in southern Arizona and northern Mexico, is on the endangered species list because of habitat loss.
Hmm. And what do those bats contribute? What do they pollinate plants or?
They do. They actually pollinate the saguaro cactuses that are out in the desert. They're one of the keystone pollinators that keep a lot of the plants, desert plants, reproducing. And they support the whole desert ecosystem. So mm-hmm. losing the lesser long-nosed bat would be devastating to the Sonoran Desert.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, Vicki, one thing is very clear. You love what you do.
I definitely do.
Are you a beekeeper?
I'm not a beekeeper in my urban yard in San Francisco. But you know what I do? I keep native bees, which means I plant native plants, have native bees come visit my garden. And I will report that I have a colony of bumblebees living in my palm tree.
Oh, that's great. Well, Vicki, thank you for joining us today. And I like to give credit when people introduce me to fascinating people like you. And it was James Anderson, who lives at San Quentin, who first introduced me to you and connected us. And I want to thank him for that.
Yeah, I thank him as well, because I really appreciated talking to you and getting the word out some more on pollinators.
Victoria Wojcik. Again, the website is pollinator.org. First it was the bees, now it's the butterflies. Thanks for listening to this podcast. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until